Here it is.
From deep inside your radio.
Wow, 2 weeks in a row in Southern California. I'll be here till the sun starts shining. That's my pledge to you. You, the listener. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a winner already in our now annual competition for the earliest start of the whole Christmas marketing blitz. And it's actually, it's a shared award. First of all, Selfridges, one of Britain's top department stores in Oxford Street, London, will start its Christmas selling season 145 days before Christmas, 2nd of August. The earliest ever start for the store. Congratulations, Selfridges, but you could do better. There's another day in August. People can purchase trees, fairy lights. It's Christmas lights to you and me, ladies and gentlemen, but you know Britain. And even a 500-pound life-size donkey. That's the price, not the weight. The store said previous sales had shown some customers, especially overseas tourists, started thinking about Christmas during August. I wonder what country they were coming from. Last year, the Christmas shop at Selfridges sold more than 1,000 baubles, no bangles, during the first week of Christmas selling after it opened on the 8th of August. So they pushed it back to the 2nd. Apparently the 1st is sacred, though. Customers can paint their own baubles this year. The buying manager of Selfridges Christmas shop put it, I think, plainly, Christmas is coming earlier each year. I can see a time when we offer a Christmas collection throughout the year. Me too. We agree on that. And coincidentally, this week also brought news that several American stores, chain stores, were either flirting with or actually introducing Black Friday in July sales. Because, you know, it's the summer thing is over. And back to school hasn't started yet. What do we do now? Well, there's always Christmas. So I think I'm going to retire the prize, unless Selfridges goes for August 1st next year. It's there for you, babe. Ladies and gentlemen, the buried lead department has a good one from the New York Times. The lead of the story was about Pakistan collecting not enough in taxes because the wealthy in Pakistan. Imagine this now. The wealthy in Pakistan don't pay taxes. What a wacky country that is. But here is the lead. Way, way, way down. Put your miner's helmet on for this one. It's not just that they're not collecting enough tax money. Here's what it says way down. This might be the lead if you were running the New York Times. Or I. While Pakistan's income from taxes last year was the lowest in the country's history. That's a while. I mean, there's more to the sentence, but just think about that. It's been around since the late 1940s, and yet its income from taxes last year was the lowest in the country's history. So you know where they're getting the money. Look in the mirror. The assets of current members of the Pakistan Parliament nearly doubled from those of members of the previous parliament. So we know where the money is going. But where the money is coming from, look in the mirror, boy. And it's clean, it's cheap, it's safe, it's too clean to meter. Entergy has found tritium levels that exceed federal drinking water standards in another location, another nuclear plant, this one in Plymouth, I believe it's Massachusetts, yes it is. A monitoring well at the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant, tritium levels were found there for the first time since the wells were installed nearly 3 years ago. Wow. Samples taken on July 7th showed that one monitoring well near Cape Cod Bay, no biggie, had more than 25,000 picocuries per liter of tritium. The EPA's maximum threshold is 20,000. The monitoring well was installed in April, so who knows? Before then. Dave Tarantino, spokesman for the plant, says the leak doesn't pose any threat to drinking water in Plymouth. And here's an interesting reason why. largely because the groundwater at the plant flows into Cape Cod Bay. Okay? Whew, that was a close one. Thank God we don't use Cape Cod Bay for anything. Or do we? A test of Cape Cod Bay water showed no elevated levels of tritium on July 7th, he said, the spokesperson for the plant. The nearest drinking water well is 2.5 miles away. Why, that would take, you know, forever. Meanwhile, Brattleboro, Vermont, a recent inspection of Vermont Yankees steam dryer, that's considered a critical indicator of aging and stress at the Yankee nuclear reactor, showed, quoting, only one new crack, unquote, according to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The new crack brings the total to 65 cracks in the steam dryer. Energy reevaluated 39 cracks identified in 2008, which were determined to be relevant at the time. They're now deemed to be non-relevant. And in case you're wondering, neither Entergy nor the Nuclear Regulatory Commission could explain the difference between relevant and non-relevant because technical staff were unavailable Friday afternoon. Out looking for tritium. Will Entergy continue to operate Vermont Yankee? A panel appointed by Vermont lawmakers to examine the reliability of the plant said a change in corporate culture is needed if the 38-year-old nuclear plant is to continue operating past its scheduled 2012 closing. Entergy cannot operate it reliably for an additional 20 years unless it successfully reestablishes a corporate culture where its individual employees and the organization as a whole have a questioning attitude and where adequate resources are consistently spent on non-safety systems. The report called misleading statements which led to the disciplining of 11 employees of the plant the result of an organization-wide breakdown, but not a part of a deliberate effort to deceive. It's just, you know, wrong culture. Can we stage a production of Carmen at the plant? You know, just get some culture there. Hello, welcome to the show.
White and blue, shines like my shoes. Baby, you should see her.
edge of America from the home of the homeless. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, something will happen. A very effective prediction on my part. Tales of airport security. That's the something I had in mind. I don't know about you. Please give. A couple of items this week. One from Michael. Actually, they're both from Michael. They're different Michaels. Apparently, they're picking on the Michaels. From Michael D. Dear Harry, so I'm going through security at JFK in New York when I realize I haven't put my computer into its own bin as per TSA regulations. As I correct the problem, I ruefully admit to the TSA agent at the bag scanner that I hadn't yet had enough coffee that day. The agent laughed and said, quote, "And I haven't had my first blunt today yet," unquote. Then expounded briefly on how blunt smoking improved her mood and general working conditions considerably. I went on my merry way. Apparently, Michael D. doesn't need coffee to be merry. From Michael R. Dear Harry, my wife and I were taking a trip to New York from Chicago this week and were faced for the first time with one of those full-body scanners at O'Hare Airport. I'd read somewhere that you could opt out of a full-body scan if you wanted, and because I'm not so sure about the safety of these devices, I thought it might be a good idea to go the opt-out route and receive a normal pat-down. From the moment my wife told the TSA agent she did not want a full-body scan, a sloppy process began where it was abundantly clear no one had chosen this option before among this group of workers. We first went through your standard metal detector, no problems there, but then we were aggressively corralled into an area off to the side where we were told to wait until a staff member was available to pat each of us down physically. During this time, we saw the security workers scrambling from their normal posts and confusedly asking each other questions about what needed to be done at this point. Things about how they should do a chemical swab of us and asking what level of pat-down needed to be conducted. Full slide, one worker asked the other. Full slide, the other responded. It was clear they had not somehow taken this option before and were unsure of how to handle the situation. So they proceeded to pat us down. Full slide. I don't think I need to explain what that means. Had us sit down as they took swabs of our feet with the bottom of their gloves, then analyzed the gloves for signs of any dangerous chemicals. It was as embarrassing as it was intrusive, especially since no one else was being put through these paces. Interestingly, my wife first asked to forego the body scanner, the first response from the TSA worker was that the machine was completely safe. I wondered why it was then that children were not being put through the device. On top of that, there was a second line of flyers right next to us who were all going through a standard metal detector. The body scanner for that whole group of people had been roped off. And not 15 minutes after our ordeal, the body scanner that we had just opted out of was shut down. And everyone was going through standard metal detectors. Needless to say, the whole experience is making me wonder about whether to opt out again if I'm confronted by one of those machines on the way home, or just take the risk to my health and go through the scanner. Love the show. Michael, if you'll just stand over there for the rest of the show, we'll get to you. Full slide. Tales of Airport Security, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. How's the Army Corps of Engineers doing? Well, they're doing what they do, and they do it in the way they do it. That is to say, there's a splendid consistency to the whole deal. Case in point, Dateline Washington. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers acknowledged this week problems with its response to the devastating floods that killed 22 people in Tennessee near Nashville this past spring. You heard about that, right? You did? The Corps stressed that the heavy two-day rainfall that soaked the state. Tell me if you've heard this excuse before, ladies and gentlemen. The heavy rainfall was so unpredictable, there is no way the agency could have been fully prepared. Who could have ever? Who? Given the nature of this unprecedented weather event, flooding was unavoidable, says Major General John Peabody, commander of the Corps Great Lakes and Ohio River Division. The Corps, as well as the National Weather Service, have been under fire for failing to quickly recognize the potential for severe flooding during the storms in May and for not acting quickly enough to alert the public about the possible danger. The Corps conceded a number of errors, including poor communication, unread email from the National Weather Service. What would they have to be saying at this point? Weather. Who would? A shortage of essential personnel on duty. Well, it was the kids' weekend with the thing. And equipment failures in its after-action report on the flooding. There'll be a congressional hearing. Says U.S. Representative Jim Cooper of Nashville, the report puts a cheerful face on some pretty ugly facts. I know Boy Scout troops that are more prepared than this, he says. Peabody defended the Corps' response in the hearing and said personnel in the agency's Nashville district acted confidently, actively, and in some cases heroically, even leaving their homes to be flooded while they worked to reduce flooding along the entire river system. There were problems, he conceded. The flooding caused the internet service in the Nashville office to go down, hindering communications between offices and agencies responding to the disaster. Maybe backup? Oh, gee, that would be radical. Hail the Corps. Evermore. And now, ladies and gentlemen.
He's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an inspector general.
News of inspectors general.
Oh, yeah.
The U.S. Department of Energy is moving quickly with no master plan to shut down a project that would have buried the nation's nuclear waste in Nevada. That's according to the Energy Department's inspector general. Moving quickly with no plan is a bad thing? Department officials have used focus groups and set a September 30 deadline to end the 28-year-long project at Yucca Mountain, according to a report from DOE Inspector General Gregory Friedman. Focus groups on the subject of a nuclear waste dump. Would you like it if it were painted blue? Friedman made no recommendations but warned of pitfalls to avoid in closing down such a large project. His report compares closing the $10.5 billion Yucca Mountain project to decommissioning the superconducting supercollider in Texas after Congress killed it. We know of no other comparable single project termination in the department's recent history as consequential as Yucca Mountain. Hanford's high-level radioactive waste, including the worst of the waste to be treated at the plant, was expected to be sent to Yucca Mountain. It also would have used nuclear power fuel. A planning framework would have increased the likelihood of overall success of the effort to shut down the project, says the report. We can't even shut it down. It promises a separate report on contractor costs. DOE also needs to take special steps to ensure that the extraordinary documentary record of the project be safeguarded for future use. Tens of millions of dollars have been spent on scientific and engineering studies, analyses, evaluations, and reviews. We can't even shut it down, ladies and gentlemen. That's how good we are. We're the can't-do nation. A federal watchdog criticized U.S. agencies this week for squandering taxpayer money on facilities in Afghanistan that are too complex and costly for the Afghan government to maintain. U.S. officials acknowledge they need to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to hire contractors to operate a complex of buildings in Kandahar and other facilities in Afghanistan for the next 10 years. Sounds like full employment to me. A federal auditor complained in a report that buildings constructed by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for the Afghan National Police represent, quote, an outrageous waste of taxpayer money, unquote. He said the problems are representative of a regular negative pattern in overly complex construction in the country. Why in the world asks Arnold Fields, the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction, why in the world are we continuing to construct facilities all over Afghanistan that we know, and the Afghans know, they will not be able to sustain once we hand the facilities over? That's me waiting for an answer. This is not the first time Washington has been accused of overbuilding projects for a frail allied government. During the Bush administration, U.S. agencies were faulted for building power plants in Iraq that were never employed to capacity because they were too complex for Iraqi engineers to operate. U.S. officials in Afghanistan acknowledged to the Special Inspector General that Afghans don't have the money or technical expertise to run the Kandahar compound on their own. The audit found that the Army Corps of Engineers didn't prepare a master plan for the complex, with the result that money was wasted on redundant power, water, sewer, heating, and air conditioning systems, like the redundant internet system they didn't have in Nashville. The project was also plagued on delays. Work fell 6 to 12 months behind schedule. A fourth project was delayed by 2 years. The auditor also faulted the agency for locating a barracks building next to the armory building, noting that the armory could become a target for attack. So the proximity is inappropriate and puts the lives of the Afghan National Police personnel living in the barracks at unnecessary risk. Well done, everybody. The Obama administration's program to help homeowners avoid foreclosure has fallen far short of its goals, in part because the Treasury Department has failed to spell out what its objective should be. That's according to the Inspector General, the Treasury Department. No, Special Inspector General for the Troubled Asset Relief Program, Neil Barofsky. Another thing where we went ahead without a plan. Well, that thing, only 390,000 homeowners have seen their mortgage terms permanently modified since the $50 billion program was introduced in March of last year. That's a small fraction of the 3 to 4 million borrowers who were supposed to receive assistance under the program, which is financed from the Wall Street Bailout Fund. And we're up to, what, record number of foreclosures this year? Good work, everybody. Finally, Northwest Airlines flouted federal safety orders in the past, but the FAA did not hold it accountable. That's according to a report by the Transportation Department's Inspector General, following allegations that FAA managers had colluded with the airlines they were charged with inspecting. In 2008, FAA Inspector Mark Lund charged that FAA inspectors who oversaw Northwest had allowed the airline to avoid civil penalties or legal action by accepting voluntary disclosures of noncompliance, which was against FAA policy. This came from through the Office of Special Counsel, which validates whistleblower complaints. You'll learn much more about them in The Big Uneasy, coming at the end of August. One night only, August 30th. Just, you know, FYI. The report substantiated Lund's complaints that the FAA inspectors in charge of Northwest failed to provide effective oversight of airlines' safety process. Delta, which bought Northwest, said, "We are currently reviewing the documents." It should be fun. News of Inspectors General, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. I'm here. I'm right over here. Ladies and gentlemen, while we muck around in Afghanistan, the British public is being treated to a public mucking about in Iraq. The Chilcot inquiry, an official inquiry into the Iraq war, rumbles on in London. And this week it roused viewers because one of the witnesses was Baroness Manningham Butler, who was formerly head of MI5, which is basically kind of the British equivalent of the FBI. That is to say, it's the domestic intelligence agency of Great Britain. And she made headlines by saying that her assessment of the intelligence was that Britain's involvement in the Iraq War increased the chances of terrorism happening on British soil. That was the headline. I'm going to share with you a few moments of her testimony to give you a sense of the whole picture of what she said.
In terms of Iraq, we were not directly involved in the decision-making to go to war in Iraq. Our focus was, and then, on dealing with the manifestations of terrorist threats in the United Kingdom since 9/11.
Perhaps you could just give us a gist of the nature of the threat that you saw at the time from the regime itself.
We regarded the threat, the direct threat from Iraq, as low. We did think that Saddam Hussein might resort to terrorism in the theatre if he thought his regime was toppled, but we did not believe he had the capability to do anything much in the UK. That turned out to be the right judgment.
Can I just ask one final question, which is related to the proposition that Saddam and his regime were in some way responsible for providing support, potential support to al-Qaeda, and even might have been involved in 9/11. Did you give any credence to these sorts of assessments?
No. There was no credible intelligence to suggest that connection. And that was the judgment, I might say, of the CIA. It was not a judgment that found favour with some parts of the American machine, which was why Donald Rumsfeld started an intelligence unit in the Pentagon to seek an alternative judgment. But there were tiny scraps suggesting contact, usually when Saddam Hussein felt under threat, and the danger was that those tiny scraps of intelligence were given importance and weight by some which they did not bear. So, to my mind, Iraq, Saddam Hussein, had nothing to do with 9/11. I've never seen anything to make me change my mind on that.
Were you given sight of some of the material produced by the Pentagon?
I don't think I was. Probably a good thing, it would have made me cross.
The Foreign Affairs Committee of the House of Commons in 2004 concluded that war in Iraq had possibly made terrorist attacks against British nationals and British interests more likely in the short term. Now, how significant, in your view, a factor was Iraq compared with other situations that were used by extremist terrorists to justify their actions?
I think it's highly significant. By 03, 04, we were receiving an increasing number of leads to terrorist activity from within the UK. And our involvement in Iraq radicalised, for want of a better word, but a whole generation of young people, some of them British citizens, not a whole generation, a few among a generation, who were saw our involvement in Iraq on top of our involvement in Afghanistan as being an attack on Islam. Really, there had been an increasing number of British-born individuals living and brought up in this country, some of them third generation, who were attracted to the ideology of Osama bin Laden and saw the West's activities in Iraq and Afghanistan as threatening their fellow religionists and the Muslim world. So it undoubtedly increased the threat. And by 04, we were pretty well swamped. That's possibly exaggeration, but we were very overburdened by intelligence on a broad scale that was pretty well more than we could cope with in terms of threats to plot, leads to threat plots and things that we needed to pursue. And, of course, also, we were dealing at that time with a number of young British citizens who went to Iraq to fight, not with Her Majesty's forces, but against them. So it became a strong motivation. And in my speech in Queen Mary College, I said this publicly. I think it's worth saying that I needed the approval of the Home Secretary to make any public speeches and cleared the text with me, and he agreed that I should say that in public. And arguably, we gave Osama bin Laden his Iraqi jihad.
We're going to fight him over there so we don't fight him over there. She's a baroness, ladies and gentlemen. And a competitor with BP's Tony Hayward for the slowest talking person in the British Isles. Speaking of Tony Hayward, going to retire this week. Big golden shower, no, parachute. And congratulations, Tony. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. Pakistan's Army Chief General Ashraq Kayani has emerged as a greatly strengthened figure now after the fragile civilian government bowed to pressure to extend his tenure by an unprecedented 3 years. Kayani previously headed the shadowy Inter-Services Intelligence Agency, where a lot of people support the Taliban, don't you know, is now poised to forge Pakistan's foreign policy at a crucial moment. The announcement that he will serve an extra 3 years, reports Britain's Guardian newspaper, caused widespread surprise. He was due to retire in November. Few thought his extension, pardon the expression, would last so long. The sudden move underscores the Army's strength over the democratically elected government of President Zardari, which has been racked by political turmoil. At least they have a government, unlike Iraq. Kayani will now outlast the Prime Minister and the President and will oversee the next general election. The Prime Minister said Kayani had to stay because Pakistan's anti-Taliban military operations are at a critical stage, and successful continuation of these operations required continuation in military high command. He commands more than 600,000 men, the sixth largest army in the world, and an officer corps that controls sizable business and property interests, and probably pays no taxes. And, also from The Guardian, dozens of Pentagon staff and contractors with high-level security clearances have been found by U.S. federal investigators to have downloaded child pornography, ladies and gentlemen. Spokesman said the Defense Department takes such matters seriously but would not comment on specific cases. The Pentagon concern is not just that crimes have been committed, but that it makes those involved security risks. One of those charged was a contractor who had security clearance at the National Security Agency. He fled the U.S. and is now thought to be hiding in Libya. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this very broadcast. Caving from the wave. This is Le Show. And now, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
And it starts right here at home in the Le Show Dome. This week, the Daily Caller, a conservative website, posted a story about email messages on a now-defunct listserv called Journolist, including one sent by KCRW publicist Sarah Spitz, regarding the prospect of Rush Limbaugh having a heart attack. She said in her email message, she would laugh loudly like a maniac and watch his eyes bug out. She said, I never knew I had this much hate in me, but he deserves it. Even though the Daily Caller identified her as an NPR journalist, she's works here at KCRW as a producer and publicist. And following the publication in the website, Sarah Spitz issued this statement. I made poorly considered remarks about Rush Limbaugh to what I believed was a private email discussion group from my personal email account. As a publicist, I realized more than anyone that is no excuse for irresponsible behavior. I apologize to anyone I may have offended, and I regret these comments greatly. They do not reflect the values by which I conduct my life. Facebook issued an apology Thursday for deleting a post by former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin. Facebook spokesman Andrew Noyes explained in a statement that a Palin post criticizing the building of a mosque near Ground Zero was removed by an automated system and had nothing to do with the content of the post. A Vancouver police officer has apologized after he was caught on videotape pushing a woman with multiple sclerosis down to the ground in one of the country's poorest neighborhoods. The 65-second video was uploaded to the Internet. That damn Internet. There it is again. It shows the 26-year-old disabled woman trying to weave her way through three male officers on a busy street. One of the officers then appears to shove the woman to the ground before walking away. The other two officers do not intervene. As I say, police have apologized. The U.S. has apologized to Russia for what it called a diplomatic slip-up in the case of a Russian man arrested in Africa and then extradited to the U.S. for alleged smuggling. The Russian government had expressed outrage at U.S. handling of the case. Open lawlessness, they said. State Department spokesman P.J. Crowley said there was an unintended delay in notifying Russian authorities they could visit the man. We have apologized to Russia, he said. The U.S. considers the matter to be closed. Representative Charles Rangel has apologized to NBC reporter Luke Russert over berating him for asking whether ethics charges will force Rangel out of his job. After the charges were issued Thursday, Rangel became angry when Russert, son of Tim Russert, asked the question. The congressman called it a dumb question. It doesn't really sound like NBC asking these dumb questions. Rangel said he'd called the reporter the next day to apologize. U.S. Senate candidate Sharron Angle in Nevada, said Friday she's sorry for calling the unemployed spoiled, but she believes repeatedly extending jobless benefits doesn't solve the nation's economic problems or encourage people to find work. Veteran Central Arkansas football coach Clint Conk confessed this week to an inappropriate relationship, and he has apologized to his family. Taiwan President Ma Ying-jeou expressed his condolences to victims of the White Terror era at a memorial in front of the presidential office. The White Terror refers to a time during martial law during which thousands of people in Taiwan were subjected to purges, imprisonment, and executions and repression by the Chinese Nationalist Party, the Kuomintang. Dateline Florence, Arizona, Pinal County Sheriff Paul Babeau apologized for his appearance on a radio talk show that's listed as a hate group. The show is called The Political Cesspool. Speaking of which, Fox News personality Glenn Beck has apologized for calling Chicago Bears linebacker Brian Urlacher a neo-Nazi during a segment on his show. Bill O'Reilly led his Wednesday program by criticizing Shirley Sherrod's language but acknowledging his own mistake. I owe Miss Sherrod an apology for not doing my homework and for not putting her remarks into proper context. Andrew Breitbart, source of the edited videotape of Shirley Sherrod, told MSNBC, quote, I feel sorry they made this about her. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said Wednesday he apologized to Shirley Sherrod for forcing her to resign. And here's presidential spokesman Robert Gibbs continuing the parade of Shirley Sherrod-related apologies.
She did accept his apology?
Yes.
Yeah.
He expressed his apologies for the events of the last several days. He thought she was very gracious, and I would say the president expressed to Ms. Sherrod that that Secretary Vilsack had, he believed, been extremely sincere in his comments yesterday, in his apologies.
Is there a reason you emphasized here that he wanted to make sure she knew that Secretary Vilsack's apology was sincere? Has there been a concern that she?
No, I don't.
She thought it was.
I don't
wasn't?
Think so. I think. Look, I think most of you all saw what Secretary Vilsack said. I think the phrase "I'm sorry" probably could or should be said a lot more in this town, and it's hard to get out sometimes.
Father knows best.
Now let me see. Organic spinach bed needs to be replaced with organic chard. You need something, dear?
Just thinking.
Well, you usually think sitting down.
I don't know. This is walking around thinking.
Okay. Organic carrots get pulled up. Organic beets go in. You wouldn't want to do that kind of thinking in your slippers, would you?
I think better when my feet are fully enclosed.
Mm-hmm. Look, baby, I know what you're thinking about.
Well, get a turban and a beaded curtain and make some money with that skill.
You're thinking about how to avoid calling Miss Shirley Sherrod and apologizing.
Michelle, you know that if it's something I've done wrong, I have no trouble apologizing.
I do? I mean, I do.
But apologizing for what Tom Vilsack did...
Because Rom told him to.
No, not fair. All Rom said was, get this off my freaking radar screen before I kick the crap out of my freaking radar screen.
Well, and you think you can hide in here from your advisors who want you to make that call?
I told Axelrod you needed my help on the garden.
And he believed you?
I didn't stick around to check.
Honey, just make the call.
All right, but what do I tell her?
You tell her you're sorry. It's simple. We women do it all the time.
Mm-hmm. You buy shoes all the time, too.
Well, I guess the White House operator didn't think I needed your help on the garden.
You want to trade? I'll put in the shard.
Barack, I don't recall marrying a man who was afraid of an angry woman.
Afraid? Heck no, I was in love. Hello? Oh, hi, Miss Sherrod. Yes. No, I just wanted to say I'm sorry for everything.
Purple potatoes go here.
Yes, ma'am. I understand, ma'am. No, ma'am. Oh, you're absolutely right. Yes, ma'am.
Red cabbage goes here.
Well, you need to know how sincere we are. Okay. Very sincere. Oh, yes, ma'am. That is very sincere on your part. Maybe too sincere. Look, I hate to blame this on an unthinking subordinate, but is there anything I can do to overcome the audacity of a dope? All right, ma'am. You tell me when. Hi, this is President Barack Obama, and I'm busy apologizing to Shirley right now, so please leave a message at the beep. All right, ma'am. You're welcome. And thank you. And you're welcome. And...
Mom, I got an A+, instead of a double A+.
Shh, honey, Your daddy's on.
All right then, Miss Sherrod, and you call me whenever you've made your decision. It's a great job. We just made it up. All right. Bye-bye.
Honey, we've got a real problem here.
Oh, what happened, Princess?
Mrs. Belvoir took 10 points off for talking during the snap quiz.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't me. It was Keisha. I just didn't want to tell on her, so I only got an A+.
Oh, sweetheart. She's your favorite teacher, right?
She was.
Well, you know what? Sometimes the smartest people we know can do the dumbest things.
Mm-hmm. But why?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe she got up on the wrong side of the bed today. Maybe they didn't have her size at the shoe store. Seriously, Sugar Plum, maybe she was losing support among white independent students.
Or maybe she was just afraid that Glenn Beck would hear about your grade.
You know, Princess, uh-huh. Sometimes you have to understand that an A-plus isn't such a bad grade either. You know, maybe you could write her a little note of apology.
But it wasn't me that was talking.
Even though it wasn't you. She'll think you're a very mature young lady. And you know what else, Princess?
What, Daddy?
Offer to do an outgoing message for her voicemail.
Okay, Dad.
Go along to dinner now, baby.
Do I have to?
Yep. I gotta help your mother with her cauliflower. No, no, it's not the sound of flying that we need to hear right now, ladies and gentlemen. It's the sound of the Olympics. Coming right up for your listening pleasure. I don't think so. I think this is all screwed up. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, without the music, news of the Olympic movement. Organizers of the London Olympics have promised full stadiums for all events and affordable ticket prices for the vast majority, but concede that showpieces, such as the men's 100-meter final, will be limited to, quote, people with privileged access. That's you, right? Yeah, that's what I thought. You seem like a person with privileged access to me. Please give. Paul Dayton, the former investment banker who is chief executive of the London Organizing Committee, says 75% of the tickets will be in a ballot for the general public, a much higher proportion than for the World Cup finals in football or rugby. But as he says, the generosity towards the average sports fan will not extend to the showpiece events in 2012. He said opportunities to see Usain Bolt in the 100-meter final will remain strictly limited, and that people with privileged access will be there. But he says, quote, someone like Bolt will be making 8 or 9 appearances, and so there'll be a big chunk of the general public at different sessions, unquote. In other words, if you want to see Usain Bolt, go to the preliminaries. Or to see someone like him. Because the Olympics, ladies and gentlemen, it is a movement. And yes, we do. We all need one every day. Spotlight now. On the news of the oil spill, BP has been offering signing bonuses and lucrative pay to prominent scientists from public universities around the Gulf Coast to aid its defenses against spill litigation. BP attempted to hire the entire marine sciences department at one Alabama university, according to scientists involved in discussions. The university declined because of confidentiality restrictions that the company sought on any research. A Marine Board panel investigating the cause of the Deepwater Horizon explosion has released a list of anomalies it believes were experienced on the rig in the 36 hours leading up to the accident. 15 barrels of the drilling mud that guards against gas kicking upward bled back into the rig at noon on the day. In the afternoon, the rig crew was pumping drilling mud out at the same time as seawater was being pumped into the well. A time-saving measure, the investigators had made it hard to track fluid in the hole. And there were more. If you understand oil drilling, look them up. The oil and gas industry's offshore safety and environmental record in the Gulf of Mexico, many people think it was exemplary. But federal records, according to the Washington Post, tell a different story. They show a steady stream of oil spills in the Gulf. 517,000 barrels of petroleum, into the Gulf of Mexico between 1964 and 2009. Those spills killed thousands of birds and soiled beaches as far away as the Yucatan Peninsula. They poured twice as much oil into U.S. waters as the Exxon Valdez. The industry's record had been improving before the BP spill. A federal judge this week stopped companies from developing oil and gas wells on billions of dollars in leases off Alaska's northwest coast, saying the federal government failed to follow environmental law before it sold the drilling rights. The sale in February 2008, during the Bush administration. But the judge said the Minerals Management Service failed to analyze the environmental effect of natural gas development despite industry interest and specific lease incentives for such development. And only 4 days before the Deepwater Horizon exploded, one of two company men who oversaw drilling operations on the rig boarded a helicopter and headed for shore to attend a training program on blowout preventers. And now there's a new PR blitz by BP.
I grew up in Libya. I've lived here all my life.
Dani Shalid, BP's chief of North African diplomatic affairs.
When the whole Megrahi thing blew up, I knew we had a mess, and I knew we had to do everything we could to make it right.
It's $50,000. Don't talk to the media again.
It meant bringing in experienced skimmers from as far away as Las Vegas.
We'll take 10% off the top of our little contribution to you, because last time I checked, that was supposed to be our little secret.
And using the most sophisticated equipment available to clean it up.
All right, I'll blame it on the Scots, and they'll blame it on me. Just for the love of God, stop!
We at BP are committed to doing whatever it takes to avoid doing whatever it really takes. And that's my commitment, because I live here too. Until they move me.
What she was headed for, it was too late. She's come undone. She found a mountain that was far too high. And when she found out she couldn't fly, it was too late. It's too late. She's gone too far. She's lost the sun. Truth, but all she got was lies. Came the time to realize, and it was too late. She's come undone. She didn't know what she was headed for. And when I found what she was headed for, mama, it was too late. It's too late. She's gone too far. She's lost the
lost the sun.
Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at this same time over these same stations. And Le Show is on Twitter, at LeTwits, now more than 10,000 strong. Join the gang, won't you? Don't be left out. Don't be a moon calf. Don't be a jabbernowl. You're not one of those, are you? A tip of Le Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, In Exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks to Pam Halstead. Check out all the fine features at harryshearer.com, won't you? I knew that you would. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.